107.1 on your FM dial. And K219KU, Nahala, serving the Oregon coast at 91.7 on your FM dial. Streaming live and archived, baby, at xray.fm. Radio is yours.
Hello, and welcome to Citizen 411, your information directory for democracy, where we want everyone represented and empowered in our democratic republic. Citizen 411 is powered by the League of Women Voters. We're nonpartisan and never promote candidates. We help people understand the issues so they can vote responsibly. I'm Tracy Riley Kelly.
I'm Teresa Torres.
And I'm Rachel Bancroft.
So our monthly civic happenings. Our theme this month is to celebrate writers, Northwest stories, creativity, and connection. And we have two local events for you to put on your calendar. One is the Clark College Writing Festival. It's a big event, and it's Saturday, May 9th, and a week-long event curated by the Creative Writing and English faculty. Celebrate writing, including workshops and readings by visiting writing professionals, faculty, students, and community members, writers and readers alike. It's free, and our guests will tell you more about it. So just look for the Clark College Writing Festival via the Google. Also free, June 27th for the KXRW Book Fair and Media Fest, also held at Clark College from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's family-friendly, welcoming setting. There will be a hands-on workshop in writing, cartooning, and storytelling, and all sorts of creative activities that support literacy and imagination. And many authors, book readings, and workshops. So save this date. The link is northwestbookfair.com.
Lastly, a quick note about KXRW. Our station is in the middle of its fun drive, running now through May 15th. This worthy little powerhouse of independent radio operates on a shoestring. There are no big corporate donors here, just community support from listeners like you and people like us. KXRW shows up for our community by amplifying local voices, local issues, and local creativity. So even if you are thinking globally, please act locally. And if you are able, consider making a donation at kxrw.fm online. Every contribution truly makes a difference.
Jesse Morse and Jen Denrow are co-directors of the Clark College Spring Writing Workshop, which is part of the week-long Clark College Creative Writing Festival. And all of these events are free. Jesse's taught literature and writing at Clark College since the fall of 2018. He has a PhD in English and creative writing from the University of Denver. He wrote Flash Floods Are Anomalies for Finishing Line Press, 2021. He plays guitar and sings in the rock band Night Paving. And most proudly, he is a devoted father to Wren, who just turned 12. Jen Denrow, who also teaches at Clark, works as a mental health counselor and writing teacher. She is the author of the book California, and in 2017 she founded 1122 Gallery, a backyard community art space that hosts artists in process for shows and conversation. Welcome, Jesse and Jennifer.
Thanks for having us.
Our first question is always a what do you do question. We are excited to talk about books and writing today. But first, what is it that each of you do at Clark College?
Well, we both teach there. Yeah, so we teach writing classes, English classes. But, you know, you do lots of other things too, like work on committees and I don't know, help students through the day at the joy of a community college. But yeah, mainly we teach. We're teachers.
Well, then, for each of you, and out of Clark College or in, what is your favorite class to teach? And what makes it a favorite? Like, just speaking about what is the joy of teaching?
Well, I feel lucky there because there's a huge... adjunct population at Clark. So not everyone gets to teach a variety of classes. A lot of our English teachers teach composition classes. But I'm lucky. I get to teach creative writing sometimes, and I get to teach literature, and I get to teach composition. So I really run the gamut. And I don't know if I have a favorite class, but last quarter I got to teach a Native American literature class, which was totally, totally awesome. And of course, creative writing's my first love. I think that's Jen's first love too. So anytime we get to actually teach creative writing as opposed to like essay writing necessarily, it's always a joy and a pleasure to see what the young kids are writing these days. Is that what you would say?
Yeah, I would say poetry is probably my favorite to teach. Yeah.
Well, we're here to talk about the Creative Writing Festival. So we know it's free. How did it begin? And what are some specific things that you'll be doing that week?
I'll talk about how it began, and then you can outline the festival. Does that sound
sure.
good? Okay. So it's actually been kind of a renaissance of a rebirth that old Clark College professor started a while ago, where there was a festival like this every spring, but a kind of a smaller version of it. And so, this is our fifth year doing it now, redoing it. And it's been amazing. It's grown each year. And it really just started because we had a lovely donation into the foundation that was primarily geared for the English department. So a way for the English department to promote itself in the community, but also to offer to the community and for opportunities for Clark faculty, because they lead, Clark faculty teach workshops, but also visiting writers come in and teach workshops, some very well-known, and then others, like, we always try to bring in really well-known writers, but also local writers, who might not be as well-known in the national scene. And so that's kind of how it started. We just applied. We were both adjuncts at that time, and it went up. Would anyone like to organize a festival in the spring? And we applied and got it. We're married, by the way. We should tell you that. I don't know if you guys knew that. So we applied together. Surprise. And we've been doing it now for 5 years, and we make a really good team. Chen is an amazing organizer of events, and I have some skill in that as well. So it just really mixed like two things that we love doing together. And I think it's just been a blessing. Yeah. It's just grown tremendously. So we're excited to see what the fifth year will be like. And what's happening this year, Jen?
So the festival that happens at Clark happens over the week, and mm-hmm. the writing workshop kicks off on Saturday, May 9th, and that opens up a week of writing affiliated activities at Clark. So the actual writing workshop that happens on Saturday, May 9th, as Jesse was saying, it's a collection of writers that come in and they offer workshops, they give readings. There is free breakfast and lunch, and it runs from 10 a.m. 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. So you can come have some coffee and a Danish in the morning. There's a morning reading, and then there are breakout workshops. So you can choose what workshop you want to go to. And we have a mix of poetry writers coming in and fiction writers and essayists or nonfiction writers. So it's a real great blend of different genres. And that's what will take place on May 9th. And then throughout the week at Clark, there are a lot of events. So Monday, May 11th, there is a nonfiction comics workshop hosted by Shay Merck. On Tuesday, May 12th, there's a reading and conversation with Emma Patti, who's also will be
there Saturday
at the workshop. She's a novelist and climate journalist. On Wednesday, May 13th, there's a release party for The Swift, which is the student-run literary journal, and that's at 11 a.m. on Wednesday. On Thursday, May 14th, there's another reading and conversation with Camille Dungy, and she's a poet and nonfiction author. And then Thursday, the English department will host the writing awards for students, and that happens at 3:30. So all of those events take place throughout the week. It's a real celebration of writing and of our student writers and our community.
Yeah.
So it's great.
So that sounds exciting. So if you've got writers, you need to have readers.
Yes.
So the three of us love to read, and So there's kind of this argument back and forth. Are people reading more these days for fun and enjoyment, or is it less given that we have so many distractions? Do you know? And how do we attract people to reading? Because I think it's a great pastime.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, in my classes, it's really interesting. I still strive, you know, in these literature classes, especially. Mm-hmm. I teach long novels. You know, I ask these kids to read long novels because, you know, I want them to have that experience. And I've felt really like they're doing it, you know. So at least when they're, you know, who knows? Maybe they're not, and I don't know. But I feel like when I'm asking for it in the classroom, I still am seeing reading. Like, I'm teaching another literature class this morning, and we just started Ana Castillo's So Far From God. Mm-hmm. It's this amazing novel from the 90s. And the discussion was palpable in class. You know, it was clear everyone, the 10, was a small class, but they had all been reading. So I do know that reading is still happening in the academic spaces. Mm-hmm. But yeah, outside of academic spaces, I don't know. That is a harder question. Does a thing like a Kindle encourage people to read, or does it not?
Right. And audiobooks as well.
Yeah, audiobooks. People,
that counts as reading.
Okay, that's good. Because some students do listen to the audiobooks mm-hmm. instead of read them. I say that's mm-hmm. totally fine. You know, mm-hmm. I just want them engaging with the text. So, yeah, it's a good question, you know.
Yeah, I think the way that my students and I talk about this, and I think the way that our conversations usually go is that reading's still happening, but it looks different than it has in the past. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is like short form content. Scanning is a mm-hmm. big part of the yeah. process of reading. So I think the conversations generally kind of revolve around, like, you know, that sort of in-depth reading, that reading that that sustained kind of longer reading mm-hmm. is less common now. And yeah, I think we just are changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have too much time left in this segment, but I did want to discuss briefly genres or the different styles or categories of books. I know many readers connect strongly to familiar labels like romance or science fiction or mysteries. Mm-hmm. What are some other genres or emerging genres that might be new or surprising to our listeners?
I would say, well, one of my favorite genres that I used to teach workshops in this all of the time, but it's lyric essays. So mm. I don't know if that's a familiar genre, yeah. but I think that's more of these hybrid genres are, I think, arising. So like you have flash fiction, you have these kind of crossbreeds of a familiar or maybe even two familiar genres that kind of get together and create their own thing. And I think with film too, we talk about this a lot with film, but certainly in books. So lyric essays, I would say that was one of my favorites.
Hmm. Would that also be what would be considered a niche genre? Can you talk to us about that?
Huh.
Yeah, I thought about this a little bit coming in here. And I mean, I think niche genres, to me, my understanding, I'm not really well versed in them, but my understanding is something like, so if you were writing a fantasy book, but it's very specifically like vampires in outer space, right? So that's the
Amish
niche.
Vampires.
Amish vampires.
There I know you go. That book.
So that's the niche genre, right? It's taking a larger genre and then making it very focused specifically on one type of thing that is often very like, mm-hmm. you know, a subculture.
Yeah.
And so I'm completely not read in any real niche genres, except maybe sound poetry. I would like to encourage you all out there to Google Jaap Blonk, JAAPBLONK, and watch some videos of his sound poetry. It's poetry okay. with no words.
Really?
So there you go. Cool. There's a niche genre.
Poetry with no words.
Yeah. Now, imagine that.
Isn't that an extraordinary thing to think about? Well, it's time to take a quick break. We've been speaking today about writing with Jesse Morse and Jennifer Denro, writers and professors at Clark College. You are listening to Citizen 411, your information directory for democracy.
The Columbian continues to offer the most comprehensive and consistent coverage of our region and our people, despite the challenges faced by local newspapers nationwide. Valued donations to our community-funded journalism project pays for reporters to provide expanded and in-depth coverage of key local issues in print and online, including housing, transportation, and the environment. For the most thorough daily coverage, visit Columbian.com. Please consider donating or subscribing today.
Welcome back to Citizen 411, and we're your hosts, Tracy Raley Kelly, Rachel Bancroft, and Teresa Torres. Today, we've been talking with Jesse Morris and Jennifer Denro about writing and the Clark College Creative Writing Festival. So, the three of us are members of the League of Women Voters, and we're really into civic engagement. So, how does learning to be a better writer help people to be more civically engaged?
Great question.
Thanks.
I think... The way that I think about it, I think writing and thinking are so intimately connected. So when I think about someone becoming a stronger writer or more effective writer, I think about them having more understanding of their own thinking process or their own thought process. So for me, I think if you are able to kind of sort through, even at a metacognitive level, like of how you're thinking about things, it allows you to be, I feel like, more informed. I mean, there's also the piece that you had mentioned about communication, right? And the better you're able to communicate your message to someone, the more conversation that can happen. And I think the more conversation and dialogue that can happen, the more engaged you would be. So I guess that's how I would think about it. I don't know if you want to add anything.
Yeah, I would just add, I mean, letters to your representatives and politicians still matter.
Yeah,
you know?
They do.
And I think of like letter from a Birmingham jail, you know, mm-hmm. by Martin Luther King, or so many examples historically of actual letters that were written that have now become things we study or even think of them as literature, you know. And it's, if you can't write, or if writing is, it's hard for you to communicate in writing, that is taken away from you,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about book banning, something that we abhor, but what happens to society when we start banning books?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the worst things society can do, you know, is to try to limit the ideas that are disseminated mm-hmm. in society, and that's really what ends up happening, right? So I have I was thinking about this question last quarter, and this was a great student, actually, but I taught a book by Tommy Pico, who's a queer indigenous writer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's lots of sex in the book and there's lots of, like, anything goes in the book. And it was really hard for this student to read this book because it went against all their religious values, mm-hmm. basically. And they really wish they hadn't read the book and complained about it, you know. And I said, thank God books aren't banned here at Clark yeah. College, because that student, you know, if books were able to be banned, like, in that, you know, if you could ban any book, like mm-hmm. you end up with one homogenous idea throughout society, right. and that's very damaging and very dangerous.
And you can always just not read it if you don't like
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
And I've allowed that to my students. Yeah. Like, skip over this section if yeah. you want, you know, but yeah. you really need to like read, engage with this book, you know. Very rare that that's happened, but it has happened a couple times. And yeah, so book banning is, I don't know, it's right up there with some of the most criminal things a society can do to its people, I think.
I agree.
So we're now living in a time when tools like ChatGPT are widely available, and that clearly affects writing. What guidance do you give your students about using tools like this responsibly, especially without letting the technology replace their own voice and thinking?
Yeah, this is a big one, and it's our department. It's like... there's a constant conversation, an ongoing conversation. The way I handle it in my classroom, and I think department wide, we're still trying to figure out kind of like a uniform approach. But the way I've handled it is to have conversations with my students and just ask them to be transparent about the ways in which they're using AI. What it gives them, what it relieves them of, the benefits, the disadvantages, what's being taken away. So we just had this conversation in my class this week, where students are thinking about the voice, in particular, about how when you stick a prompt into ChatGPT and you have it spit something back out, it lacks that humanity, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we look at a piece, we talk about this is what an AI generated response looks like. And we talk about what it's missing. It doesn't feel there's no voice there. Right. And so I think having these conversations with students, and I try not to be very, I try to be really open about it in my classroom, so it's more of a conversation, because I want to hear their perspective. It's like they, you know, they have so many classes, every teacher is asking them to do so much. They have outside of school a lot of commitments, and so I think generally they reach to it because they feel rushed, because they feel like there isn't enough time in their day, because they don't have any flexibility. Teachers are saying you have to turn this in, it has to be done, and so they feel stuck, I think. And I think that's the main reason they use it.
Right.
I'm a writer, and I greatly value editors. And I think everyone needs an editor. How does an editor, or even just asking one other person to look at what you wrote, help you do better communication?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, without question, like, writers throughout history, historically, you're always sharing your writing and getting feedback on it. And so the main way, if you're specifically asking about communication, is, and something we teach in our classes with peer review, which is a huge part of classes, that's what you'd call it in a composition class. But in a creative writing class, you call it workshop, usually, right? So you share your writing, and then you get feedback on it. So how to incorporate feedback, not take the feedback personally, you know, to improve rewriting. And you do that in life too, right? How do you improve your life from feedback from other people, your partner, your boss, or your colleagues, or whatever. And so the editor, the word editor, you know, implies a certain relationship in a way, like a hierarchical one. It's somewhat in a fiction world, I think, where you send it off to an editor and they make suggestions. But it is always up to the author, right, what the final thing is going to be. So I don't know. As poets, I think we think about it more as like you send it to a friend to get feedback and workshop on. If you're a fiction writer with a fancy contract, you probably do have an actual editor that you work with who's really like shaping the book for you to be publishable, right?
You
so,
hope.
But either way, the communication is the key to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think too, especially for our students, they think of editing, when you ask them to like peer edit or peer review, they think of it as like, let's just go through and find where the commas are missing. You know, they think of it on a very like grammatical sentence level way. And so really we have to kind of guide them through. This is a revision process. You're engaging with someone and their ideas and their the way that they're thinking about something and the way that they're languaging the way they're thinking. And so we really have to kind of open up that understanding of what editing is to help them understand it's a conversation between two people. And you're saying, this is what I'm understanding you say. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe how you could make it clear, you know, this is maybe where you could develop it, or maybe it's too developed and you need to press it down a little bit. So I think that's a big part of it. Yeah, they think of editing as just like, where's the, you know, what is the misspelled word? Where's the missing period? So we try to expand that a little bit.
Well, and certainly people can become better writers by attending classes where they would hear feedback and going to the free Clark College Writing Workshop on Saturday, March 19th. So, like, what, like, I'd like to ask you then a question, which is that many fantastic works of fiction are great because they are using some great writing conventions. Mm. What is an example of a book that you really love and you could say to somebody, this book is great and it's using some writing conventions that are admirable?
Well, in the Native Lit class I mentioned earlier, I got to teach Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silko. I don't know if you all know that book, but it came out in the 70s, and I mean, to me, it's so funny that term great American novel, you know, when people say that, they all just think of like novels written by old white men and
Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah. And in my mind, like really all the great American novels have been written by people of color, you know, in this country, because it captures our country in a much more intimate and realistic way. And I think Leslie Marmon Silko's Ceremony is like, there's no better novel that's been written in the U.S. in my opinion. And it's just incredible. So I recommend that book for everyone. And the characters and settings are all amazing. And the conventions are actually, the structural conventions are unusual in that book, and that's one thing that makes it so interesting. The way time, the way the narrative's portrayed and the way time is used and the way the characters move through the world is much more reflective of indigenous wisdom than our Western way of thinking. So yeah, that would be that. That's the one that came to mind when you asked me that question.
What about you, Jen?
Oh, it's so tough. Even on the way here, thinking about that, and it's so hard to just think of one example. I just think in poetry, one of the things I'm really drawn to is repetition, and what if you're thinking about a poetic convention, what repetition can do, how it can be used. So one of my favorite writers is a poet named Larry Levis, and I think he employs that convention really skillfully and beautifully, where when you come back around to, you know, the same line or the same concept, and that repetition kind of threads through his work, it feels new each time, but yet it also feels like part of this lineage or something longer. So that would be my answer.
I'll just add to that. Usually when I answer a question like, who's your favorite writer, or what's your favorite book, it's often just the book I'm reading at that moment.
That's what I always say.
It's the one I just read last week.
Yeah, it's true.
So I'm curious now, what are you reading at the moment?
Yeah.
Well, actually, our poet friends in Portland just invited us into an Ursula Le Guin book club.
Oh, fun.
So we've been reading some Ursula Le Guin for the first time, which has been cool. It's hard to read outside of when we're during the term. It's actually really hard to read anything other than what we're teaching. But as I mentioned earlier, right now I'm immersed in So Far From God by Ana Castillo and discovering her work. She's incredible. What are you reading, darling?
Yeah, I feel like we've been reading the Le Guin books, and we're not really steeped in sci-fi, so this is like a new terrain for us. So learning how to, like, you know, experience a sci-fi book has been great. But yeah, that's mostly what I've been reading. I feel like,
actually, you've been reading Christopher Tuton's book too, who's come into Clark, a wonderful author coming from up near Seattle, who teaches up there, indigenous scholar and author, and he's coming to the workshop on Saturday.
Good to know.
Yeah.
It's going to be a wonderful asset of the KXRW book fair, because there are going to be authors just all around, you know, all sorts of tables, and often authors selling their own works, which is a really hard thing. And we just have a little over a minute, but is there any little piece that you would say about how to find a publisher in 1 minute, or how to?
As poets, I feel like we don't dabble in that world.
Well, it's very genre-based is another way to say it, you know. So it really depends on what you want to write. If you want to make writing like part of your life professionally and try to get published, it's really genre-based. So if you write poems, like, it's a whole different thing than if you're trying to get a fiction contract, you know. So I just think research, like anything. One thing I always tell my students, and I always do, is see that if you like a book, see the press that wrote it and get in contact with the press and ask them how the book came to be, and the press will always get back to you.
Ooh, that's a fabulous strategy. Well, that's our show. As we said in the beginning, we are in awe of what you do every day. Thank you, Jesse Morse and Jen Denrow. I'm Tracy Riley Kelly with Teresa Torres, Rachel Bancroft, and this is Citizen 411. We'd like everyone represented and empowered. Citizen 411 is powered by the League of Women Voters of Clark County, and it's produced at KXRW. Remember that KXRW is having a fund drive right now. Why don't you go online, check out the station, KXRW.org, and then look up 99.9 on the radio. And if you like what you hear, find our show.
Support for X-Ray comes from Beeline Urban Delivery. Beeline supports businesses with access to zero-emission delivery, warehousing, and advertising services. More at b-linepdx.com.
Did you know X-Ray FM has a newsletter where you can stay up to date on everything the station is doing and some of the coolest events in town? We cover concerts, programming to watch, station updates, and plenty more. Stay in the know by signing up at xray.fm/newsletter.
Hi, and welcome to Northwest Book Talk. I'm Patty Gresher, and today I'm joined by author Michelle St. Romaine. Now, Michelle, she's a writer, an educator, and a workshop leader. Her work explores memory, ancestry, and the powerful threads that connect generations. She's the co-author of two poetry collections and has taught creative writing across California, Hawaii, and Oregon. Her debut novel, Song of Belonging, is a beautifully layered multi-generational story infused with touches of magical realism. It weaves together past and present as one woman uncovers the hidden legacy of the women who came before her. The book has already won a Reader's Favorite 5-star award and is sure to continue to be a Reader's Favorite for many years. Michelle will lead a creative writing workshop at the Northwest Book Fair, which we are very excited to have her do. So, Michelle, welcome to Northwest Book Talk.
Thank you. I am so happy to be here.
So let's start from the very, very beginning. So what first inspired you to write Song of Belonging?
Yeah, so that is a story that goes back a long ways. I have loved writing in books literally from my earliest memory. I am just one of those people for whom books and stories and writing is a first love. I have memories of holding books as a very young child before I could read and just being in wonder at them and deciding very early that if I could write something that people would read, that could be that would be a successful life. So I've wanted to write for decades. This story in particular is a story. It took a long time before I did novel writing. As you said, I started as a poet in college, and I've worked in the nonprofit field for most of my adult life and used writing in that way, working on causes I care about. But about 10 years ago, I decided I really want to write a novel. I want to try and see what I can do in that form and set this goal out for myself. And I have a deep love of ancestor stories. I've always been interested in ancestor stories. And I grew up in a really wonderful culture, French Louisiana, South Louisiana. On both sides of my family, the French lineage goes back a couple of hundred years. And I grew up with aunts and uncles speaking French and English and strong French culture, the food, the music, all of it. So when I sat down to write, it was pretty clear that what I wanted to do was tell some stories of my ancestors, because those are the stories that had really been singing in my head for decades.
So that is very interesting. When I first opened the book and it was about these ancestors, you kind of go back from, you kind of flip back and forth from one period of life to another. And for me, that was very interesting because I don't really have those stories that go way back. And so that was kind of like a whole new experience to kind of go into that multi-generational writing, which like roots or something, but a whole different way. What about the magical realism that you kind of dropped into the story and kind of wove it in together? Was that also part of your heritage, that kind of mystical background?
So that's a great question. So, the term magical realism is a literary term. It's a term that we use to describe stories where it's the real world as we understand it, and kind of magical, what we consider to be magical things happen in that world, and we come as a reader to accept them as kind of normal and as an important part of the story. So I would say I grew up in a world, a culture, like many cultures shaped by the water. I grew up very near the Gulf of Mexico and with the rivers and waters, ways all around us. I grew up in a culture with kind of stories that go way back and a storytelling kind of culture. Within that we never would have called it magical realism, but I would say there was an element of that, of accepting kind of the, maybe the supernatural, that which is beyond what we see and understand as a part of life. I will say for sure that I've been reading forever and ever, and my North Stars are some of the greats in this genre. Well, Toni Morrison, I think, is one of the best writers of the last century and a half. Isabel Allende, I love Alice Hoffman's work. So there are many, many great authors who write literary fiction, but with this magical realism piece to it. And I've been reading them for generations, you know, for a long time, well, generations, for decades. And so it just felt very natural to me to kind of aim in that direction as I wrote this story.
And there's another element that comes through, I think, very strongly through your book, and that is some of your descriptions are almost poetic. And so I'm just wondering, catching the element of description in almost a poetic form, do you think that working with poetry for so many years before influenced your writing?
Oh, it absolutely did. Absolutely did. I had a book launch event this past weekend, and the co-author of the two poetry books, Alma Rosa Alvarez, I live in Southern Oregon, and she is on the English faculty at Southern Oregon University, and she was in the audience, and she asked me the question, which I kind of laughed because she knew the answer, but it was great to have a conversation, and that was the question, was how do you go from writing poetry to writing fiction? And as I shared then, I think of poetry as like these small sculptures you create. An idea comes, or for me, a phrase will come, or an image, and I catch it, and I sit down, and I write whatever comes, and then I work with it. And you can kind of hold a piece of poetry in your hand and keep sculpting it. I think that practice of doing that definitely, definitely helped me in writing this novel, because it is very place-based. It is very... the imagery and the description is really important, I think, for the reader to be able to really get a sense of, first of all, this French Louisiana culture, but also the current day story about this young woman who is having her great-grandmother's memories. She lives on the West Coast. She's trying very, very hard to live the life that she wants to live as a writer. And then all of these things start happening to her. She's having her great-grandmother's memories. And the work of trying to bring the reader into that kind of experience, writing poetry, I think definitely was helpful to me for that. And I would really take my time in those passages and work with it almost like I work with a piece of poetry to capture in a small passage a lot, with a lot of layer in it.
Yeah, I think that, and that element also, I think, might even be one of the reasons that you won that 5-star Reader's Favorite Award, because it's just well woven together in a beautiful way.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind. Thank you.
So let's start, though, go back a little bit more with you. When you first wanted to write this novel, what were some of the first things that you did? This was your very first one, so you weren't, you know, didn't have a lot of backlog of what to do. What were your steps for starting out?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And, well, how about if I tell you a little bit about where the story came from in my brain, and then that would help to help this, you know, help share a little bit of the steps. So in the story, Alice is the main character, and she's, you know, in her 20s, and she's living on the West Coast. She's one of three sisters who grew up in New Orleans in this big French family. She moves to the West Coast and is pursuing her career. And then one morning, she wakes up in Berkeley in a new apartment. She's kind of disoriented. And she unpacks a box and finds this jewelry box that her great-grandmother had given to her decades earlier when Alice was 7 and her great-grandmother had just passed away. So, you know, first she remembers receiving it. So the reader learns a little bit about the great-grandmother and the story. And she it's been put away for like 10 years. So she opens it, and when she opens it, it has kind of this Pandora's box piece to it, where then all of these things start happening. It's almost like in opening that jewelry box at this point in her life, all of the stories of our ancestors are opened and begin to insert themselves in her life and really force her to look at her life and then to look back in her own family stories and make some decisions about her life. Well, when I was 7, my great-grandmother left me a green jewelry box. So that piece of the story is based on actual fact. From there, it's all fiction. It's all made up. It is all inspired by listening to stories of my parents and aunts and uncles and grandparents and great-grandparents and lots of older cousins. I come from a huge family. But it's fiction from that point on. But when I was 7, my mother's mother, my great-grandmother, passed away. And the day before her funeral, her daughter, my great-aunt, handed me this green jewelry box. And she said, "Little Graham wanted you to have this." And I was just, I still remember this moment. I remember her putting it in my hand and I thought, why me? And I said that because there were lots of grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And she said, I don't know. But she said she wanted me to make sure I gave it to you. And I remember opening it. And so the scene where Alice remembers it, all of that is pretty close to my memory of what happened in the setting and the African violets in this little room in New Orleans. Now, when I opened the jewelry box, there was nothing in it. So my brain, of course, began to, a storyteller that I have been forever, started to kind of, I think, create stories in it. And I did think about what did this hold and that idea of all the stories that came before me. So I think that the story was actually born in that moment when I was 7 years old, but it, you know, decades later before I began to write something with it. In the story, there is a letter, as you know, and other things that the great-grandmother leaves Alice, and that was all made up, but that's where it started. So I started with some passages around that, and I just let the story begin to lead itself. And then, you know, quite honestly, the New Orleans story, so the story that's set, it's the dual timeline, so the current day where we're following Alice in her life on the West Coast, and then it goes back and forth to her great-grandmother, the one who left the jewelry box for her, writing to her young daughter who has just passed away, and it's a big mystery, and the story kind of hinges around that. That whole piece set in the 1930s in rural Louisiana really just kind of rolled out of me. I've joked that I think my female ancestors have been just hanging out with me, waiting for me to write stories. And that story of the great-grandmother feels like it just kind of rolled out of me. So there's a lot more. You know, I did a lot of work. I applied to and was accepted to a year-long women's writing program for literary authors, worked with lots of people over several years to get it to where I feel like it was ready to go into the world. Yeah. Lots of back and forth, lots of revisions, lots of working with making sure that the arcs of the characters in the two timelines flowed in the way that I wanted the reader to experience them. And it changed quite a bit. The end story is quite different than where it started in the beginning when I started writing it in 2018.
Okay, so you were at it for what, actual writing for about 7 years.
Yeah, I started it Mother's Day of 2018. And I finished it the evening after dropping my son off at college, University of Oregon. I rented a very expensive room for myself right on the coast to finish it. And I waited to write the prologue that night. Wrote it with the door open and the ocean crashing outside. And wrote the epilogue. I wrote the epilogue that evening. And that was in September of 2023. And then it went through some revision, and it was a fall of 2024 that it was accepted by She Writes Press for publication.
So what was your process in getting it accepted? Did you have an agent? Did you send out a lot of letters? What was the struggle there?
So She Writes Press, you don't need an agent. So I submitted it directly to them. And I had met Brooke Warner, who is the, you know, she's the owner, the senior editor of the whole press and the founder of She Writes Press. I had met her actually in the fall of 2018 at a writers' conference when I just started it. And she was interested in the story at that time. And her interest in it and her words of really encouraging words about where I had the story at that time really was a big part of keeping me going. So I was really thrilled to go back to them. I submitted it to them, and they had a couple of suggestions to strengthen it. So a little bit more developmental editing, which I did, and then we did a final agreement and contract. So it's not with an agent, it's directly with them.
I like that thread. You said a thread between She Writes Press that kind of motivated you to keep going, because I think that's what we all need. We need that affirmation by a real person that kind of helps us to see a project like writing this through. Would you say there was any other people that with the writing that had writing influence besides all the books and things that you read?
Oh, many, many. So I was very happy to be accepted to work with Kate Moses, who's a literary author. She lives on the East Coast. And so to do some one-on-one work with her, she has a writing program for women who are writing either memoir or literary fiction. And so I reached out to her, submitted some work to her, and the book was still in process. And she accepted me to work with her. I worked with her for about 6 months one-on-one, and then she invited me to be a fellow in her year-long program called Book Garden. And that was really remarkable. And that was a one-year program. There are five of us in the program, five women from all over the country, in a one-year, very, very intensive program, all of us working on either a novel or a literary fiction novel, a memoir or literary fiction novel. We met every week for a few hours. We would each meet once a week individually with Kate on our writing, and then we had 2 week-long residencies in the Adirondacks. And so that was very instrumental. Kate and the women I worked with really, really helped me to keep moving with getting it going. Lots of friends, you know, early readers. Certainly my family who listened and kept supporting me. And I found just a great deal of support. And then there's a lot of authors here in Southern Oregon who have been just amazing, really great support team to keep me going. And we're all cheering each other on. Several of them working on their next novel. So it's all wonderful. And I would like to just give one little shout out here. I'm very excited. So there were five of us in that Book Garden program. Mine is the first one to be published. One of my dear writing friends now who was in the program, Tara Badstubner, her book is about to be released in the fall, in September, by Sibylline Press. Very excited about that. It's called Every Room Remembers. So keep an eye out for that one as well. Tara was in that program with me as well.
So one of the things that you bring out that I think is important to share is that though writing is a single endeavor, obviously, there's still a need for some support, some guidance, some structure. And you yourself lead some writing workshops. So tell us about your experience, maybe first starting your first workshop and how it has made a difference with the writers you've helped and maybe even yourself as you help other writers.
Yes, I've actually been thinking a lot about this. It is true that writing is solitary. It's absolutely true. But I also think we have to remember storytelling is communal. Storytelling, whether that's poetry, long-form fiction, memoir writing, anything, any kind of storytelling is communal. It's one of our oldest forms of art and community and connection. So I think that it's really important. I know there's some authors who do it alone mostly, but for me and for many, many people I know, that communal connection is critical. So I started long ago as an English teacher for a while, and I asked the principal, this was way back, I was teaching middle school, and I said, could I please teach a creative writing class? and maybe offer it to the students who are really kind of high level in English and who I don't think are being challenged enough. And she said, sure, design it and let's see. And it was such a magical experience. I loved it. So I started there. And then I continued. I left teaching in a classroom. But then I, you know, when our kids were young, I volunteered in the school to continue to teach creative writing to kids. And then I moved to working with adults in creative writing a few years ago. And it just started with me, people who were curious about this journey I was on, invited a group of friends to come and hang out in my living room one afternoon and do some writing workshops together. And then it very, very quickly evolved. And, you know, I've been leading workshops and retreats of other kinds for decades through my professional work. So it was a really easy crossover. And then it just very, very quickly got bigger and people wanted to get into a full year-long program. So I now offer, I offer online workshops. I offer in-person kind of retreat afternoons. I offer two full weekend retreats a year. And I offer one-on-one work. And then there are a handful of women who sign up for a full year with me where they just pay kind of one flat fee. And anything I offer all year, they have access to. And it's been wonderful. And it keeps me going, too. And it keeps me, as I prepare for each one, it keeps me thinking and digging deeper because I really want to offer something of value to people. So it has me really looking deeper into my own process and offering what I can back.
So I love all that. Let's talk just a tiny bit on a retreat. What would a weekend retreat for a beginning writer with you be like?
Yeah, so I will have one in September. They're here in the Rogue Valley, Southern Oregon. Gorgeous place. It's at Hummingbird Estate, which is a winery, and we have this wonderful cottage, and people can either stay on the property or get another place to stay, or there's a lot of, you know, there's local writers. They tend to be pretty small groups, under 10 people. What I do is take us through a weekend. I personalize them, first of all. I will have a theme. And then what I will do is then when I see who's signing up, I find out from each person what they're working on or what they want to get out of it, and I plan based on that. So, for example, say it's somebody who's just starting and they're curious, all the way to people who are, you know, there's a few women working on novels or collections of essays, and so they're in a very different process, a place in the process. We start on Friday early evening and we go until Sunday early afternoon. And the weekend is sprinkled with times where we're connected and where I'm offering kind of sessions where I have a process through the weekend that takes us from that in the beginning, letting go of what we left behind and really kind of diving into what we want to accomplish. And then Saturday, there's usually three sessions throughout the day that guide us through steps to get us to deepen into our work. And on Sunday is often sharing and then next steps. Then I offer one-on-one in between. I always have art and creative activities available for people because I think writing is not just, it's not just words. It's, we're inspired by all kinds of things. So I use other types of creative process, and then it's in a beautiful natural setting. So that's kind of the format of it. But really, I think some of what's the most enriching for everyone is the connection and the conversations between people. It's all kind of a jumping off point. Everything I present is a jumping off point for discussion for everyone to deepen into their work.
So I imagine that some lasting friendships are kind of made from these weekends.
Oh, absolutely. So absolutely. The women in the year-long program have their own little group chat. They meet outside on their own often to do writing in between workshops. Everything I do as well, I people leave with all the materials of everything I've done so that they don't have to kind of hold it all in. I often draw from works of writing that I love. I draw from great writing teachers' works, bring all that there so people can look at it. And then when they leave, they have it all written in a handout so they can go back and explore more. And then they also always leave with follow-up next step activities to keep the process going. Whether they continue with me or our group or not, it's they leave with more so it doesn't just end. Yeah, it's a wonderful group of women who've kind of formed around this, and definitely friendships and writing groups that have formed and reading groups outside of it of women who've connected through these Women Write workshops.
So our final question is that you will be leading a workshop at the Northwest Book Fair and Media Fest called Stories That Shape Us, Writing Inspired by Memory, Family, and the Past. So can you kind of explain what the attendees would get in that 1 hour free workshop?
Yes, I'm really excited about this. What I want to offer to people in this workshop is a mini taste kind of the process that I used in writing Song of Belonging. It starts with, are your ancestors whispering to you? And if so, are you listening? Because I believe our ancestor stories are with us. I believe they're in our bones, and I believe that, you know, there's a lot available to us. And no matter what we believe, we can open, I think, at the very least in our imagination, to what might be there. So we'll talk a little bit. I'll do a little bit to kind of get everybody relaxed and warmed up and connected. And then I'm going to offer some writing prompts to get us each to dive a little bit into this question. Well, if my ancestors were talking to me, what might they be saying? What might they be asking? And I'll guide us through a process of writing and some sharing. It'll depend on the number of people in the room, how we'll do that. I think it's important to share as well, because we externalize a little bit, and it brings us a little bit more into our own bodies and experience when we at least turn to one other person and share a little bit. And then we'll see what gets created from that. I'll share a little bit of my own process, as well as some great reading for people to look at. As I said, people like Toni Morrison, Alice Hoffman, others. And then people will leave with a handout of ways to continue this type of writing if they want to do it. So it's kind of exploration of into our ancestors' past. What's there? What is there? And what might the message be for us if there was one?
So thank you, Michelle, for being with us today and for sharing your journey and your beautiful story, Song of Belonging.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here, and I'm very, very excited to be at the fair coming up and to lead a workshop. And yeah, I appreciate you inviting me on.
Okay. So I've been talking today with Michelle St. Romain. She's the author of Song of Belonging, a powerful and beautifully written novel about ancestry, memory, and finding your place in the world. You can learn more about Michelle, her writing, and her workshops by visiting her website and following her on social media. All her links will be on Northwest Book Talk. You can look up Michelle and see all the connections that you can make from there. So thank you for joining me today on Northwest Book Talk. I'm Patty Grasher, helping authors connect with readers one story at a time. Join us for the Northwest Book Fair and Media Fest Saturday, June 27th at Clark College in Vancouver. This free, family-friendly event features over 100 local authors and media creators, hands-on workshops, and exciting panels that feature storytelling in the Pacific Northwest. Meet your next favorite author or media creator and be part of a vibrant creative community. Learn more at northwestbookfair.com.
KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years. Licensed in Washington State, our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at BuckleyLaw.net. Buckley & Associates, we speak your language.
우리는 여러분의 언어를 구사합니다.
我们说你的语言.
Nosotros hablamos tu idioma.
중도의 nói ngôn ngữ của bạn.
For over 20 years, Vancouver Family Magazine has been covering local news, recreation, travel, education, parenting, personalities, and more. We connect your family to people, places, ideas, organizations, helpful resources, and local stories. Pick up your copy every month at over 300 locations all around Clark County, or read online at VancouverFamilyMagazine.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X for even more local news and family fun at Vancouver Family.
Hi, I'm Lizzie Rose from Portland. Thanks for listening to X-Ray FM. Radio is yours.
X-Ray FM would like listeners to know about the Alberta Abbey, a new 501c3 nonprofit venue dedicated to nurturing the arts in Northeast Portland and amplifying opportunities for Black and underrepresented communities. Alberta Abbey aims to serve this mission by providing affordable spaces and showcasing diverse programming for the community. Learn more about us at albertaabbey.org.
Are you a music fan? Well, of course you are, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to X-Ray. I mean a real music fan. The kind who loves the history behind it and a wide variety of it. Do you just like older music from back before algorithms made every new song sound the same? Do you like breakfast? Well, if you answered yes to any of these questions, why not crack some eggs, put on some coffee, and start your Saturdays with Raise a Glass, your musical almanac. Find out who passed away on this day?